Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. This week, Acting Travel Editor Georgia Boscawen sat down with Martin Enkel, who is one of the co-founders of a company called Nansen Polar Expeditions. Georgia was actually fortunate enough to join Martin and his team on board the 71-metre expedition vessel Nansen Explorer in Iceland earlier this year. They caught up on some of the highlights from the trip, which included an incredible encounter with humpback whales, I understand, and talk about the plans with Nansen Explorer moving forward. It is guaranteed to make you want to book a charter in Iceland immediately, so make sure you stay tuned for that. I should also point out that it's going into that story from Georgia's From Georgia is going into the December issue, which we are closing now. But before that, Charlotte, you've been out interviewing an owner this morning whose boat is very special indeed.
I have indeed. So I've been talking to the owner of a very special yacht, like you say. He's called Shirish Saraf, and his yacht is the famous Kalisma. It's always really exciting when you get to meet the people, the current owners of these really historic, beautiful boats that you recognise and know a bit about. So a quick history for people who aren't familiar with her. She was built in 1906, so a long time ago, and designed by G.L. Watson. She was one of the first steam-powered yachts to have electric lighting, and she served in both World Wars. She was an auxiliary patrol yacht during the First World War, and she was also active during the Second World War and was responsible for saving the lives of crewmen from over 1,100 vessels. So a very noble past, but she's probably most famous for the fact that Richard Burton bought her for Elizabeth Taylor back in 1967. It's where he proposed her twice, and he gave her the 33.9 carat Krupp diamond, which is now called the Burton Taylor diamond. It's absolutely enormous, and he bought it at the time for just over £1 million, if I'm good at reading numbers, I think I am. Which set a new record at the time. You'll probably recognise there are some very glamorous, iconic pictures of her in a long white dress with her hair swept up, wearing this massive rock, and that was all on board Kalisma. There's another great shot of her, which I always assumed was her kind of going up the steps to a private jet or something, but she's actually going onto Kalisma with her hair kind of all over the place and wearing a cape and looking very glam and very Liz Taylor. So it's a boat with a really interesting past, and he's an interesting guy.
So why is Kalisma called Kalisma?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Stuart. I have made some notes. Kalisma is called Kalisma because of their daughters, Kate Burton, Lisa Todd, and Maria Burton. So Kate, Lisa, Maria, Kalisma. So that's the catchy name there. Isn't Johnny Depp's old boat was a merging of names?
It was something like for Jolly Roger. So it was named after his kids, I understand. But it also kind of came out sounding like for Jolly Roger, which is obviously quite cool, given his connections with pirate movies.
Yeah, sometimes these names work and sometimes they don't so much. You have to luckily name your kids with that in mind, I guess. But anyway, her former owner, Vijay Malla, had already done quite an extensive refit on her. But Shirish has kind of gone one step further and done a massive refit over the past year. So a lot of it is tech stuff, some kind of new high-tech kit. But his design team have also lifted things and made it a lot lighter. So there's a lot more white space, a lot more neutral colours, still a lot more wood, which is kind of staying true to her original bones, I guess, but lighter. And he's also changed the top deck, which did have a jacuzzi up there and wasn't very well used. He's changed that to make a kind of big space with day beds and a little galley for watching the sunset. Anyway, you'll be able to get all the details about that in Boat International soon. But the two things I kind of took away from our conversation is one of those guys that will talk about all sorts of things all day. But one was that I thought was quite interesting that when I was asking him about the refit and what he was done, I was approaching it from a purely aesthetic point of view. But he was saying, look, this is a boat that was built in 1906. I'm taking my daughter on it. I'm taking my wife. I'm taking my parents. I want to make sure she's properly seaworthy. So a lot of the refit work was actually kind of, I guess, making sure she was a bit more solid because she wasn't in the best condition when he bought her just over a year ago. And he wants to take us to some pretty adventurous places, so that's obviously key. The other thing that just made me laugh is Richard Burton quite famously said that he spent twice as much on the refit of Kalisma as what he paid for. So I kind of joke with him, oh, you know, have you fared any better with your budgeting? He's like, no, he reckons he's paid four times as much as he on the refit as he actually paid for. So I think and hope he didn't pay that much for her, but certainly she's had a lot of work done. He's really started from scratch. And yeah, it's very exciting to see her restored to some former glory.
And you can charter her. So she's on the charter market. So you can kind of sleep. Actually, you can't sleep in Liz Taylor and Richard Burton's bedroom because I think he's changed the layout a little bit, hasn't he? So I think where their bedroom was is now the galley. So it's, you can't sleep in Liz Taylor and Richard Burton's bed, unfortunately. I'm sure that would add a few dollars to the charter price. But the but it is a very, very special boat with great heritage and tradition. So it's pretty cool that it's back out there and cruising around and on the market.
Yeah, and it sounds like he's really been getting the use out of it as well. I've had a few conversations with owners and people this week. I actually was speaking to a guy who gave his boats away to charity, and he was saying, look, we're just not using it. And it's so often the case that people who own these amazing boats are kind of lamenting the fact they're not spending long on board. And in a way, that's one of the kind of silver linings of the pandemic, is that people have been being able to actually spend time on their boats. And he was saying he'd spent, you know, 4 to 6 months on board on her working, and he's going back out imminently and definitely making the most of having such a beautiful boat.
So I know a little bit about Kalisma only because I spoke to Peter de Savary a couple of years ago. We did a big interview with Peter, and he owned her for a period in the 80s, and she served as his support, well, the kind of the base of operations for the America's Cup campaign that he was running at the time. I think it was out in New Zealand. And but he was telling me that when he took ownership of it, the bedroom was original and it was all pink. Apparently it was an entirely pink bedroom.
I like that. I think it was Vijay who changed it. So the owner, just before she was, he moved the master cabin. And now I saw some pictures of it today. It's quite big. It's quite kind of spacious given the size of the boat. So maybe it was a good move, but you're right, it's a shame for it not to be, you know, lying in the same place as Richard and Elizabeth.
Yeah. but it's look forward to seeing that in the magazine. So that's going to be a few months, but it will be a brilliant story when it is done. Actually, talking about, you just mentioned something else that triggered something, owners using their boats. So I was talking to a guy called Bobby Genovese the other day, who owns a 46 meter Fed ship. And his boat has been in Thailand. He hasn't seen it for 2.5 years, just because it's been such a nightmare getting into Thailand because of the strict quarantine COVID rules. He hasn't seen the boat in 2.5 years. He said it's like having a kid in college. And you never see them. You have no idea how they're doing, but all they do is ask for money.
Yeah. Well, while I was with Sharish, he was calling his captain, and you get the sense that they like to kind of check up on it, you know, like, how's my boat? Like, yeah, it's okay. He's like, oh, great, we're just saying hi. Like, you know, we like to kind of check in.
It must be being in having your boat an awful long way away. At least Sharish has seen it recently, and he sounds like he's spent a lot of time on board, which is really good.
It must be weird though, doing a refit of that size without being able to get out there. And I sort of said to him, oh, you know, have you been doing Zoom calls with your team and stuff? And he said, no, I don't even know how to use a computer. I don't do tech. So it must be slightly nerve-wracking. I think he was very chilled out about it, but I'm not sure I would feel so happy kind of waiting to see if my boat, you know, a bit like that older 90s program Changing Rooms, like you've got to hope you like the end result when you get on board your boat. But anyway, you were out and about as well, weren't you? You were in exciting foreign climes.
Yeah, so I just got back from Saudi Arabia. I was out seeing so there's a development in Saudi. Well, if you're familiar with the country's Vision 2030, there's all these giga projects going on in Saudi Arabia, one of which is called NEOM, which is this vast area the size of Belgium, and it's being set up as kind of a kind of a state within a state. So it's obviously a part of Saudi Arabia, but I think they expect it to have slightly different rules and bylaws than the rest of the country. It's going to be interesting to see how that all works out in practice. But the idea is to create this kind of development on the Red Sea coast and attract super yachts down there. They're developing an island called Sindala. They're going to build, amongst the giga projects within NEOM, is something called the Line, which is a 170 kilometer long strip of a city that starts at the coast and runs right through the mountains into the desert. It's incredible. And there's going to be no cars in this city. It's going to house up to kind of 5 million people. And they want these kind of like the young, creative tech community to move there. And yeah, the way they were talking, it sounded like science fiction to me. It's going to be like flying taxis and hyperloops and maglev trains and all this kind of stuff that is just so exciting to hear. But the scale of it is so vast, it's almost impossible to wrap your head around. But it's, yeah, if they pull it off by 2030, they deserve a thorough pat on the back, because it is a hell of a project.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see some more development going on around the Red Sea, because I think that's quite underrated. You know, when people talk about crystal clear waters, you automatically think of the Caribbean or some of the Med, but they have some beautiful beaches, and just the water there is amazing. And in some places, it's really unspoiled. So it'd be good to get more yachts going to those areas and get a bit more development happening.
Yeah, the water is amazing. And that was, I professed to a profound ignorance of Saudi Arabia before going out there, at least, topographically and in terms of, I knew it was hot, but I didn't quite expect there to be quite as much. There was a bit more green than I was expecting. And there was these beautiful mountains, you know, rising up out of the desert. And it was actually much more interesting than I thought it would be, just from a spectacle point of view. And the beaches were amazing. And it's got these lovely corals as well. We all went out snorkeling over some coral gardens, and they were just absolutely stunning. So yeah. I mean, the potential is there. It's a long way to go before they've got floods of super yachts, traversing the Suez, transiting the Suez, coming down to the Red Sea. There's a lot of work to be done before that's realized. But I think as a future potential cruising destination, there's definitely a chance of it becoming one, I would say.
Well, I know that there's a development there called Amala, who we've kind of been in touch with as they've been making their plans and things. And it's worth mentioning that, just because I was quite impressed when we were doing our kind of ocean talks, our sort of ocean conservation event that we do every year, someone mentioned, oh, you should speak to the guy from Amala. And when you think of these big developments, I'm afraid I have quite a negative association with them, because very often they kind of come in and build those huge areas of natural marine habitat and don't really give back in the way that they sort of pay lip service to, but don't actually. But was really impressed with the guy from, you know, they've got a few kind of proper scientific experts with bona fide scientific CVs advising on how they can make this development. It was things like, you know, having a noise limit on yachts and having certain restrictions in place to make sure that the habitats were protected. So they're really taking it very seriously and putting a lot of effort into making a kind of sustainable development rather than something they put up quickly and then doesn't necessarily do much good for the planet.
Yeah, that is a key part of all these developments. The mandate is they've got to be as green as possible, which kind of, it seems a little ironic from the world's biggest oil producer. I think the US might be the, I need to check on my oil producer league table, but Saudi is of course definitely up there. But that's it. They understand that the oil economy is a finite thing, so they've got to, you know, dig their heels in now and start building these kind of future developments and attract a different kind of economy to the country. And that's the point of all these giga projects and this Vision 2030. And so Amala, I didn't see Amala. That's a bit further down the coast. That's separate to NEOM. But same kind of, not quite on the same scale, but, you know, also, you know, very impressive project, as is the Red Sea project, which is even further south. All over that Red Sea coast of Saudi, there is a huge amount of work going on. There's not a lot of construction just yet, but Vision 2030, they don't have a lot of time, so they've got to start excavating fairly soon.
And are they going after Saudi owners or people from all over?
People from all over. They really want to internationalize the incoming visitor. They kind of saw what happened with Dubai on the east coast of the Saudi Peninsula and Abu Dhabi and even Oman to a lesser extent. And I think the Saudis feel like they slightly missed something. So, you know, with the Red Sea coast, it's much closer to Europe. It's 5 hours in a plane. kind of from some of the major hubs. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch it all happen.
Well, actually, yeah, there's a few kind of new pockets opening up that could be great super yacht destinations. But if you're listening to this and kind of thinking you'd like to get out there and go somewhere a bit more off the beaten track, then you might want to put our Explore Yachts conference in your diary. That's coming up on November the 11th in Monaco, so not long to go now. And there's going to be a whole host of travel experts, security people, companies who know all about tech and toys and gadgets who can help you work out what's possible with your boat and the time you have available and your budget and all that kind of thing. I was speaking to Rob McCullum from EOS, who's going to be there, the other day, and he was kind of saying quite often owners want to do something, you know, a bit different, and they just think it's not possible with, you know, it's not possible with their boat, where they want to go, it's not possible. And it's only once you start having those conversations that people realize, yeah, actually we could do this, or actually that's, you know, they get excited about it and they realize it's all possible. So if you're sort of dancing around the idea of doing something, definitely come along and join us, and you can take the first steps, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a brilliant day of discussion and debate and all that kind of stuff around one of the most exciting markets in super yachting. And just a few weeks after that, a few terrifyingly short weeks, frankly, is the Super Yacht Design Festival that's happening in Milan from the 1st to the 3rd of December. That's a day and a half of, again, you know, just brilliant speakers from all sorts of creative industries. If you were at the last one, you'll know what we're talking about. We had a guy, a creative director of Google. We had some brilliant people speaking, and we're upping the ante once again. So Charlotte, why don't you just, a few of the headliners, why don't you mention a few of the headliners?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned a few people last week, but I don't think I did mention, and if you're a diehard fan of the podcast, you might remember ages ago, we had this sensory scientist called Barry Smith on. He worked with Heason about how they could kind of reduce their noise levels. But he's a fascinating bloke. He has this Center for the Study of the Science of the Senses, I think it's called. Bit of a tongue twister there, but he basically studies completely your senses and how they interact with each other. And he's going to be looking at how that can feed into yacht design. But I think his talk is going to be really interactive and fun. We're talking about getting kits for people where you have to touch certain fabrics while you're eating certain jelly beans while you're standing on one leg. It's all a bit bonkers, but really fun and interactive. And every time I speak to him, I end up doing kind of weird science experiments over Zoom. So if you're in the audience, I think it'd be great. And nice to have his perspective basically on what different owners want in terms of the textiles and the fabrics and their colours on their boat based on their senses. And that's a lot to do with where in the world they come from and their kind of cultural expectations of what's nice and not so nice. I'm making it sound terrible. It's going to be really good.
It will be really good. I know it will be really good. It's going to be a great couple of days. So the information about those events is on our website now. So let's get into the news. And top of the news, as you'd expect, Ocean Cove's 127-meter-long record-breaking sail yacht Project Y721 has been glimpsed for the first time coming out of the shed in Holland. And this is reported to be Jeff Bezos's boat. It will become the longest sailing boat in the world upon delivery. Beating, Charlotte, any idea what it will be displacing at the top of the tree?
Sailing yacht A, if you count it.
Well, sailing yacht A...
It's always a debate. We have this debate kind of on a weekly basis in the office. For so many articles, we end up kind of, tossing up if it counts, basically.
It does make us have to caveat everything, sailing
yacht A. Yeah, exactly.
So if you...
Quite inconvenient, really.
Yeah. So if you discount sailing yacht A, because strictly it's a motor sailor, I would say, then this sailing yacht will become the biggest, and it will kick the 109.5-meter 1931-built Sea Cloud off the top of the league tables as the biggest sailing boat in the world. And not only will it be the biggest sailing boat in the world, Y721 will be Ocean Cove's largest ever build. So she looks pretty traditional from the pictures. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but it was, it's not quite as avant-garde, or to be fair to Ocean Cove, the thing's not been delivered. So we might see some cool new design features before it hits the water. But, you know, it's a beautiful lines, fairly classic shape. It will have three masts, and Ocean Cove obviously being very tight-lipped about the boat's owner, as you'd expect. And they would only say that Ocean Cove values the privacy and confidentiality of all our clients and prospective clients, and therefore does not comment on our involvement or non-involvement in specific projects. So yeah, no comment on the Bezos front, but yeah, it's pretty,
it definitely is,
it's pretty, it's pretty well reported. Anyway, it should be a really, really special boat when it's eventually delivered, and fingers crossed we get an opportunity to actually see it. Keep you posted.
Next up, we've got the news that Vandervolk's 34-metre explorer Lady Lean has hit the water for the first time. Commissioned by a repeat client, the all-new design features a wave-piercing bow with giant windows offering panoramic views and wing stations for easy docking. Lady Lean will also be fully wheelchair accessible thanks to an elevator servicing all decks. The design and naval architecture is a collaboration between Guido de Groot Yacht, Diana Yacht Design and Ginton Naval Architects. Accommodation is for up to 10 guests, split between a bridge deck VIP with a balcony and aft terrace, an owner's stateroom on the lower deck, and a further single and two double cabins on the same level. The owner's brief was challenging and adventurous, according to designer Guido de Groot. There really was no comparable reference point for an elegant explorer like this, which made this a very enjoyable project, he said.
It's a big boat for Vandervolk. They've come a long way in the last kind of decade or so. They're doing some really cool stuff, and they've got into this kind of pocket explorer market, and they're doing a good job. And this one looks very, very interesting boat indeed. Next up, we have in Catamaran Corner, electric yacht builder Silent Yachts has...
Catamaran Corner. Your favourite. It's almost like you've engineered this to talk about catamarans, even though it's just the news.
Yeah, it's all the news is happening in catamarans. Electric yacht builder Silent Yachts has sold the first unit of its 31-metre flagship model, the Silent 100 Explorer. Designed by Marco Casali, the first Silent 100 Explorer is due for delivery in 2023. So revealed as the builder's new flagship at the 2021 Cannes Yachting Festival, the Silent 100 Explorer features a beam of 13.62 metres and a 440 gross ton interior. 441 gross tons on 31 metres. That is a big volume boat. Spread across four decks, the yacht is fitted with a solar electric drivetrain, providing a cruising speed of 10 knots and a top speed of 14 to 16 knots. So designed to have worldwide cruising capabilities, the yacht features solar panels fitted along the hard top that slide out. Now, you've got to see the picture of this to understand what I'm talking about. So please go and have a look at it on the website. The solar panels basically at the very top kind of slide to port and starboard. So they kind of overhang the boat and they reveal this kind of sun deck seating area that's very, very cool. It could also serve as a touch and go helipad, on a 31 meter boat. Speaking about the sale, Silent Yachts founder and chief executive Michael Kohler said this new sale comes after the sale of three of our 80-foot models in rapid succession and confirms the market's interest in the superior comfort of catamarans and solar energy for propulsion needs, as well as all the household appliances on board. So really exciting on the eco front, really exciting on the catamaran front, and Silent Yachts have just come from nowhere again. In the last 10 years, they've just... Really, they've just struck a chord with the market, and now they're building this, well, frankly, massive 440 gross ton interior catamaran. Good on them.
All right. And lastly, we have Dutch yard Heesen has begun construction on a 50 meter steel superyacht called Project Oslo 24. The yacht, which features an exterior penned by Clifford Den Yachts and interiors by Luca Dini Design and Architecture, passed the keel laying construction milestone on October the 4th. The owners and their family attended the ceremony and welded their good luck coins to the metal. Described as highly customised, Project Oslo 24 is based on the platform of Heesen's 50-metre steel-class superyachts and was commissioned by an experienced yachtsman, the yard revealed. The yacht will feature hybrid propulsion, which draws on both diesel engines and electric motors, either together or individually. Friso Visser, Heesen's chief commercial officer, said, "We were the first shipyard who dared to take the financial risk of building hybrid yachts on speculation, and today all our yachts are available with hybrid propulsion as an option." Interesting to see another hybrid yacht out there.
Well, I mean, it's kind of the market expects them all to be now, I think, doesn't it? I mean, it's almost very unusual to see a new build coming out or announced that's not a hybrid model. I think that's the minimum expectation, frankly, from superyacht owners nowadays, as it probably should be.
Absolutely. Well, that's due out in 2024, so keep an eye out for that.
Thanks, Charlotte. So let's so the data story this week, we're doing things a little bit differently because our data guru, Raphael, is out touring Italy and collecting data for our annual Global Order Book report. So we've decided instead to do a bit of a teaser into some data being presented at the upcoming Explorer Yacht Summit in Monaco on the 11th of November, which obviously is all to do with the Explorer market. Okay, so when you look across the Explorer Yacht industry or the market as a whole, so there are 714 Explorer Yachts in total, including those on order and in build, which out of a fleet of something like 13,000 odd boats isn't very many, but it is a rapidly growing part of the market. When you look at the average length of the boats, in 2011, the average length of Explorers was 35.03 meters, and in 2021 that has crept up to 44.75 meters, and it's a similar story in gross tonnage terms. In 2011, the average gross tonnage of the Explorers on the water was 431 gross tons, and in 2021 double at 1109 gross tons. So it's interesting as well looking at expedition activity, because you know there's some criticism sometimes of these Explorer yachts, as in they're just made to look tough, but they don't really do anything. They just kind of hang off Saint-Tropez. But the proof is in the pudding, and we know more and more boats are doing cool stuff because we've got the AIS intelligence from Boat Pro. So the number of super yachts visiting the Arctic every year from August to October, in 2018 the number was 12, in 2019 the number was 32, in 2020 that obviously took a dip because of COVID, but 11 still made it there. In terms of the Antarctic, in the 2017-2018 season, from December to February, there were 7 boats. In 2018-2019, there were 11. In 2019-2020, there were 24. So more and more boats going to these extremes every year. And one last little insight. I don't want to spoil the entire data presentation that will be delivered at the summit, but we could just look at the brokerage market, which is kind of the kind of most reactive part of the market. And so in 2009, 6 Explorer yachts were sold in the brokerage market with a combined asking price of 56 million euros. In 2015, that number had risen to 15. Explorer yachts sold in the brokerage market with an asking price of 122.8 million. And in 2020, that number had climbed to 54 super yachts, Explorer super yachts sold on the brokerage market. Bumper year 2020. With an asking price of 614.6 million. So that just goes to show a bit of a snapshot there to show you how much the market is advancing. And that's it from News and Data this week. Thank you very much, Charlotte. Stay tuned for George's interview with Martin Ecknell from Nansen Polar Expeditions.
And I'm here today with Martin Ecknell, one of the co-founders of Nansen Polar Expeditions, who I was lucky enough to travel up to Iceland with and visit the spectacular West Fjords on their newest addition to the fleet, the Nansen Explorer. Martin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
We had the most incredible time in Iceland with our extraordinary and actually quite emotional whale encounters, wonderful food from the chef, hot springs, the list goes on. But really, she's just the coolest project. Well, certainly the coolest project I think I've ever been on for a while. So it really was the most unbelievable pleasure to be a part of that. So first of all, I'm incredibly grateful. But second of all, it's rude not to share it with the rest of the world. So we're going to start right at the very beginning and find a little bit more out about you and your incredible journey to where you are today. So we would love to know how polar expeditions became such a passion for you and now obviously such a large part of your life and your career.
I think that the polar travel started early in my career as well, just a few years into when I've started working on expedition ships. And it's an unreal world when you go to Antarctica or the High Arctic. And I think like anyone who goes there for a trip themselves, anyone who works in the industry as well, are blown away by the magic of the landscape and the ice and the animals and the vastness. So I think it's easy to get hooked up in those regions.
Definitely. And before before you were actually a part of and before you founded Nansen Polar Expeditions. You had the most incredible career in polar exploration as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into that and perhaps a little bit about your extraordinary and very impressive CV as well?
Well, I started in 94 on the ships, and I had been already starting with a little bit of dive work for recreational diving. And I was actually in the Maldives working as an instructor when one of my old friends had become an operation manager for a company that was operating in Antarctica and the High Arctic. And I had such a good time in the Maldives, so I turned him down a few times. And then finally, he actually flew down to the Maldives to make me sign a contract and come and join, which I'm very happy that he did. So I did diving and expedition trips prior to the polar regions. And I was actually on small ships all the time and basically just loving it. But it was, I think it was with the small ships as well, everyone tried to handpick anyone they know are good and capable in that sense. So that's why he didn't give up on me in that sense.
And was it definitely the cool climbs that stole your heart rather than obviously the warmer climates of the Maldives?
Yes and no. I went back to the warmer climates again, but it felt much more like a challenge and an interest, and more like proper work on an expedition ship in comparison, maybe to the Maldives and those areas. Plus, it was so relatively new and difficult to get a job on the small ship. So it's you know, you wanted to learn more and more, and you know, you wanted to start diving in the polar regions and things like that. And it was endless options on the small ships that you could do really, really cool things.
Why was it so difficult to get a job? Was it just demand? So many people wanted to do that.
I think when I started, and it may sound very old now, but when I started at that time, it wasn't like you were reading on job applications on the internet and CVs here and there and big companies asking for a lot of a lot of expedition staff and so forth. It was a limited fleet that operated at that time. It was not that it is today. Big ships, a lot of Zodiac drivers and so forth. It was much, much smaller, and it was not easy to find a job, so to say.
I see. And I know that this is probably quite a general question, but since you started doing this, what has been the most challenging expedition to date?
Well, I think with the amount of expeditions, it's hard to remember them all, but we had a classic event on an island called Penguin Island in Antarctica, which is a small volcano, where the ship got the grip file for a week's weather, and there were no updates within that week. So we had a bonus landing that lasted over 20 hours because a hurricane decided to change its route and go straight over the island. So it became a more challenging 24 hours than maybe a whole expedition, but it was the first bonus landing also after the Drake Passage coming down to Antarctica. So it was an interesting start on that trip, and I ended up 6 hours in a Zodiac in that hurricane force on my own. So it was an interesting start of trying to have radio communications and make sure the clients were safe ashore and so forth, and try to get them off the island safely.
Well, you still obviously are very keen to do it, so it must have also been quite exhilarating as well.
Yeah, it's always a little bit interesting, and get a little bit adrenaline when things are happening. It's being kept very safe, but a little bit of weather always makes you feel that you're actually in the environment properly, you know, the polar regions.
And moving on to the yacht, the 72 meter marvel that is the Nansen Explorer. And I know that, I mean, especially when we were on board, she was very much referred to as a ship, because she's so capable, and it was that. I mean, we travelled up, I think it was the whole extent of the west coast, is that right? So we went from Reykjavik right the way up. And
yes.
Even though the weather was pretty shaky, I mean, I know that very established seafarers would say lumpy seas, but it was they were quite big seas. So, and she got up there without a hitch. I mean, she's the most incredible boat.
Yes, she was built properly for polar research. So go both Arctic and Antarctica. So she was designed from the beginning to be in those kind of waters. She's built by special steel and an ice knife to be able to be properly into the ice. She has two main engines, which is, you know, always feels nice and safe to have a backup engine when you're crossing the big oceans. But she is a very, very capable ship, and they are built to move around a bit as well, even if not everyone feels it's comfortable. The ship itself is extremely safe.
Yeah, and obviously that's hugely important. I mean, it gets a little bit beyond looks, which is why, you know, she's a world away from the white yachts of Monaco, but just so, so capable. Which I think I remember speaking to a lot of the crew on board. It's a really exciting element of the whole project, that she's just so incredibly capable that it's limitless where you could go to. So incredibly exciting for potential charters.
Yes, I think also what we have tried to do from the beginning is also make it crystal clear to everyone that she is not a white boat. We don't want to be compared to a white boat in that sense, because that would be not being truthfully, you know, honest to the clients. We want a ship that is more of a, this one is more of a hybrid, from having the luxury of only being 12, but to do things that most of the yachts going to Antarctica or the Arctic can't really do, because of the ice class, because of the helipad, and of course, because again, the luxury of being 12, you can do so much more. She is compared, and it was interesting to handpick the crew, because she is compared to a 72-meter white boat, but she is almost double in volume. So the space is also amazing on board, the deck space, the cabin space, with the refit that we have done.
Yeah, and I remember we actually had a little tour of just how much storage was on board. It's just huge amounts of cold storage. And I mean, can you tell us a little bit about the previous life of her as well?
Yeah, so there were 10 of this class ordered from Russia, and they were being built in Finland, again special steel and special ice class, and most of them were designed for scientific projects, all handed out to different cities in Russia. And in the 90s, four or five of them got converted into passenger vessels, so they then got a classification of 80 people on board. So normally it's somewhere between 50 and 60 passengers. So that's why she already had that size of her. We believe, and it's hard to find all the information about these ones, we believe that this one became a privately owned yacht in Russia. And then she was bought by the Norwegian government, and being the Sysselmann and the police vessel up in Svalbard. And that's also why we have a very large helicopter pad on board that could take and can take the Super Puma, the big rescue helicopter. So this one stayed as a research vessel or a police vessel before we found her. We had a lot of extra space, and also because we don't want 50 or 60 clients on board, we want 12.
And how much work actually needed to be done to her before you were able to call her the Nansen Explorer? How much work needed to be done?
Well, it was quite a lot of work. We found her in Hull in the UK. So we were there a couple of times for classifications, for the dry docking, for the 5-year class, and all of those things, the hull inspection. So already there, we had a lot of work. Having her in dry dock there, it allows us to do more, to start giving her the proper name, to paint her, and get rid of a lot of oceanographic research equipment that was on board before we sailed her home. And then once we got her home to Norway, we had a plan with the whole interior team interior architect and interior design, trying to make her as Scandinavian Nordic looking as possible, to get all the colors that we have in the polar regions, the green and the blue and the copper colors from animals and so forth. We wanted to put that on board so it should match the environments that the clients are traveling in. But I think at the end we had between 40 and 60 contractors on board when we're coming to the final touches of the interior space. And then, of course, having a ship, I guess you are never finished with the repair and maintenance. So we did sea trials for a month. We had you guys on board for one trip, and then we took her back to Norway again to touch up the things we had found that didn't work or the things that we wanted to change. And now we are back in Iceland getting ready for a charter day after tomorrow.
That's very exciting. And that is technically the first official charter. Am I right in saying that?
It's the first official charter, yes.
Not that ours felt like anything other than that, because it was still the ultimate experience and the utmost luxury and everything you could possibly hope for. So, I mean, I'm sure it'll go incredibly smoothly, as expected. So for such a young company, having been established only in 2019, Nansen Explorer isn't actually the only project that you have. You also have Villa as well. And can you tell us a little bit more about this project?
Yeah, so Villa is the reason we started the company. We want to have working vessels that can do more than just one thing, that if in case we get different kinds of charters, we want to be able to have scientists on board or do a work or a cargo project and so forth. So she was the one we found first of all. And she is smaller, she is 42 meters, built also for ice conditions. She has a large crane and she has a big cargo deck and cargo space. And our original thoughts and plans for her was to operate for film teams and photographers up in Svalbard for polar bears and walrus and so forth. So we found her and refitted her, and she started her operations as soon as she was ready. So last June, she started on her first private charter, and then she has been up in Svalbard this whole summer, just returning back to Norway a few days ago after a very, very nice first season up in the ice.
It's just incredible. I mean, I think anyone would be in absolute awe of the team and yourself just for being able to have two projects on the go out there at the moment. It's just astonishing. Because I am right in saying 2019, aren't I?
Yes, we found Villa and started the company 2019, and we were very lucky. We have put in a lot of hours and worked very hard to get to where we are today. So we managed to get a film crew up to Svalbard to be there almost alone, because they cancelled on the tourist season. So that was also a big luxury for us to be able to be up there. But it's been, of course, a lot of work, because a lot of the owners are also part of the projects physically. So it's been interesting and lots of fun.
Are you able to tell us a little bit more about how that works? Because you mentioned briefly, and obviously I know firsthand, that you have the most incredible team on board and behind the Nansen Polar Expeditions as well. And how did you go about finding such a well-established and competent team?
I think that with the team, that a few of us knew each other, and then the rest knew each other separately. All of us are from the marine industry, so to say. We are all, most of us, or quite a few of us, the owners are crew members, ex-crew members. We are guides. One is a captain who is captain of Nansen Explorer and so forth. So there's a lot of knowledge within what we are doing in the project. And then the rest, we have been very, very carefully handpicked for anyone in the team, knowing their part of their jobs and what they are capable of. So there's a lot of experience. There's a lot of experience from the superyacht world, from superyachts in the polar regions. There's a lot of experience from the two different ships we have. There's a lot of experience from both expedition and luxury. And that was one of the things we wanted to do. We wanted to do things a little bit better to give the clients the ultimate trips, which we know that are not always happening because of the crews and the guides and so forth might not have the experience. And we wanted to do that a little bit better.
But also the team is made up. You've missed a very important point that I think all of you are incredibly talented photographers, and not just talented, award-winning photographers as well. So that's obviously an amazing aspect, because I'm sure a lot of the interest of polar expeditions, you want to be able to capture that moment, and photography is obviously a very great way to do that. And is that you have the most incredible among you, there's all kinds of awards floating around. And was that a big part of it? Was that as a big driver for the project?
Yes, we have two of the owners who are award-winning. Our CEO is probably our greatest photographer in the team, who has won a lot of awards. Myself, I haven't won a single award just yet, so I'm just a hobby photographer.
Not yet, but it'll happen because I've seen them.
But no, it's definitely been a big part, because it's also that is the world we want to show people. You know, we want to make sure that the clients, if they come, they get the best time out there. Our experience with animals out in the field is, of course, with many, many years, knowing that you learn a lot of animal behavior, which of course is very good for nature photography, that you can read the animal a little bit, so to say. And a lot of clients are nature photographers that have an interest in our two ships.
And how also, so obviously you are embarking on this incredible journey with EOS as well. How did that collaboration come about?
So our collaboration with EOS came about in the sense that we have worked for many years together with EOS. Our COO in the company has worked on Border World with EOS for many, many years. So we also have become good friends, and myself has been on their ships in the polar regions and in the tropics for over 10 years. So it was a natural collaboration if they would be interested to work with us, because to me, they are, you know, there is no one like them in the field. And then I think that it would be the best for the clients as well, for our two companies to work together.
Yeah, and I hope many of you will see in the December issue that the element of surprise was also a huge part of the way that EOS and Nansen did things. We were told a vague itinerary, and then suddenly we would be whisked up in a helicopter or being taken to hot springs or without our knowledge, which was an incredible part of it. And I think a really lovely way that you have designed together with EOS these expeditions, which was just such great fun and just made it that little bit more special for me anyway.
I think it's for everyone the same feeling in that sense. Normally also we don't want to over-tell a schedule, also because of the areas we are operating in, because of ice, because of weather, because of maybe we hear about or we find better animal operations or experience somewhere else. So you want to take it step by step and rather have a lot of backup plans so that you don't disappoint clients and build their trip to a much greater trip than they maybe expected. But also those small things to throw in into the mix, it's normally the ones that are the biggest surprises and the things that guests are talking about for a long time, if you can do them, of course.
So from your perspective, what is the ultimate goal with the Nansen Explorer? What do you see her achieving in a few years' time, or going? Where do you see her going?
Well, I think that first of all, to get her up and running now and then get her to Antarctica is our goal. Again, we want to offer trips with clients that can take her into the ice. It's what people want the most and remember the most is to go into the ice in the Arctic and Antarctic. That is normally the best time of their trips. And again, with Nansen, we want to offer that so you can have the white boats coming to Antarctica or the bigger ships, and they are maybe not built for that. So you still get an amazing experience, but going into the ice is something that is hard to beat.
I'd love for you to describe what that's like, just being in the ice, and because I've never done it, and I'm sure many people would love to do it but haven't had the chance to do that. What's that actually like when you're breaking ice and there's no one around you? It must just be the most extraordinary experience.
Yeah, I would say it's very hard to explain it. I think it's better for people to come and see for themselves. But it is a world that is it's so incredibly peaceful. And people tend to be out on deck for hours, and you know, you can slow down and stop the ship and or just cruise in an area where ships weren't or aren't supposed to be, so to say. So that's of course great to have a ship that's actually built for the ice, because it's so few that can do it. But it is a magical world, and it's yes, it is hard to explain.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I'm sure so many people would love to experience that because it just seems like a whole nother world. But you can only explore on so few projects. So basically, hopefully everyone will get out on the Nansen Explorer and discover it.
Well, we hope so. But I think also one thing is going through ice, but very often what happens in the polar regions because of current systems and drift ice is that the ice very often blocks off areas where every ship could go to, which means that if you can go through those bands of drift ice, you can access that whole area that maybe that ice band is blocking. So you are more likely as well, of course, going on a capable ice ship to get a full experience of your trip.
So is there a conservation angle to the project at all? Is that something that you've thought about approaching?
I'm sure there are big plans in the company to do something for the future. Personally, I've been on board both Villa in the summer and now here on Nansen, so I haven't been a big part in that plan. But I know that they have had discussions, but I'm not sure if I can give you an answer right here for that. I'm sorry.
Because I'm sure so many people would be interested just because it's so capable and more than so many projects. I'm sure that many people looking to charter or things like that would be interested in maybe exploring something with a conservation angle. I mean, it's just an idea. Maybe not. Where is the Nansen Explorer heading to next? So you're about to go on charter. Is that back in Iceland as well?
Yes, we are back in Iceland as we speak. We are in Reykjavik waiting for the client. We are going to do, at the moment, we have plans for to the west coast again, to the fjords and some of the islands, and do some land trips. And we are here for about 2 weeks, a little bit more than 2 weeks now.
Fantastic. And hopefully another spectacular encounter with a whale as well, which was just extraordinary. Surely you have them on demand.
Yes, yeah. No, we keep an eye on the whale boats who go out for the whale watching, and they are leaving as soon as it's good weather they go out. So the whales are definitely here. So we'll hope that we can find them again.
Perfect. And also for you personally, you've seen so much of the world, what could possibly be on your bucket list? Is there anything that you desperately want to do?
Not really to places. I've been extremely fortunate to experience the places I've been to. I'm more of course hoping that we'll succeed now to show other clients, you know, the world that we are so experienced in and can give them the ultimate trip, so they are you know, loving the ships and want to come back and see more worlds with us. That would for me be on the on my bucket list, I think.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for that. It's just so wonderful to hear a little bit more about the Nansen Explorer and what she's going to potentially get up to. And hopefully in the December issue, we'll be able to shine a little bit more light on that as well, where you can see some ridiculously incredible photos. I mean, some of them are slightly cringeworthy on my part with me jumping into the waterfall in a dry suit, but you know, a little bit of everything in there. But I'm so incredibly grateful for this today and just such a wonderful trip as well. So thank you so much for that.
No, thank you. Very welcome. It was great to have you on board. And now hopefully we can do more of those trips for others as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.